This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. Thank you all so much for coming out. My name is Dennis Moynihan, and I'm here with Amy Goodman on our Election 2012 Silenced Majority Tour, roughly halfway through 100 cities. Thank you. There's Amy, and there's the book, and we'll be out later with Collected Works, signing books and answering questions for those of you who have any. And please feel free to hang around. We don't have to be in Los Alamos till 3 a.m., so. But it's really, it's, again, such an honor to be here. Just seeing the list of people who have been and who I've been here with at the Lensic and who are those coming up. I mean, I cannot feel more out of place. But I feel, I guess, the way Obama must have when he was given a Nobel Peace Prize a couple days after he got elected. So I intend to earn my place at this podium, hopefully following the example of this illustrious people who are part of the Lannan Foundation's In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom program. So it is, it's my distinct pleasure and honor to be here. The Lannan Foundation is singular in the kind of conscientious, dedicated, open-minded, and risk-taking philanthropists, activists, philanthropists, caring people, friends. And so really, it's no surprise to me that they have set up their shop here in Santa Fe in northern New Mexico. It is such a strong community, such a progressive community, and has always been such an enormous base of support for Democracy Now! And the work of Amy Goodman. So first, thank you to Patrick Lannan, Andy Took, and Lori Betlach, and Barbara, and the whole staff, and of course, with just everyone. The work of Democracy Now! Is, as Amy says on the show, and the largest public media collaboration in the U.S. It is the work of so many people, and part of that is this the strength we get from the support. And I can only thank just the many times we've come here, the incredible support that we get from this part of the world. So thank you all for what you do. Noam Chomsky says he can tell when addressing an audience if there is a good community radio station in the area, and you've got many of them here. So thanks to KSFR, KUNM, KRZA, your soon-to-be on-air KCEI and KCEY in Taos, the Cultural Energies, two radio licenses, the public access stations that carry Democracy Now!, Santa Fe Community TV, Channel 16, Taos TV. There's always a fight to protect our community media institutions. They are to be supported, preserved. They deserve and need your participation on any level. And so we just had a very storied, successful, and progressive nonprofit managing Albuquerque's public access system, quote unquote, and through a lot, basically the same kind of votes, the balance of votes that we see in the U.S. Supreme Court. They lost their contract to a firm favored by the Republican majority there at the Albuquerque City Council. So it isn't a done deal, I'd say, that quote-unquote still persists as a viable entity with camera gear, with the mission to support, educate, and promote independent media. But at the same time, the control of the channel capacity is currently out of their hands. So it's just a lesson to me as I travel the country, work with Democracy Now!, that we have to always keep an eye on what is happening both at the policy level and then right here in the streets. How can we protect and shore up independent media? True inspiration in that regard is the friend and colleague who I'm about to introduce. So I'll let her speak more about that. She is just such a... Amy Goodman is a tireless, courageous, and dedicated journalist. She's taught so many people, some who've spoken here. I remember, Jeremy Scahill. Many of you probably know him, met him, read his work, and read it in The Nation. He's got another book coming out with a movie, so he's really follow him. Got his first days as a journalist training at Democracy Now! I remember being backstage here with Amy and Sharif Abdelkaddous early in his career at Democracy Now!, and it's just been remarkable to see his trajectory, and now he's reporting full-time in Cairo on the incredible revolutions that are happening over there, the ups and downs. So it's I guess can't say how nice it is to be here. It's really so rewarding. I have, as we said, to be at Los Alamos at 3 a.m. Now, why would you go to Los Alamos at 3 a.m., you wonder, unless there's some physicist who stayed out till last call or something here in Santa Fe. I did study some nuclear chemistry in, as an undergrad, but that was long ago. So we are doing this tour, and part of it is the silence majority was kind of a phrase that Amy uses a lot to describe the mission of Democracy Now. What is it that prevents so many people from participating effectively in our democracy, or even going out and voting? Obviously, historically, there's just been very little incentive and for many people, the sense that it isn't worth it. And now we see the stakes are so high. There are so many efforts to prevent people from voting. And so we're covering roughly 100 cities. And on the weekdays, we have to do the broadcast. We produce Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. Eastern Time, so that's 7 a.m. So did anyone catch the broadcast from Freeport, Illinois, the Bainport encampment? That was at 7 a.m. So we had to meet the satellite truck at 5 a.m. And now we're in the mountain time where I live in Colorado, so I should be used to it, but we have to keep going an hour earlier, and we're heading towards the West Coast where it really gets challenging. So. But it's worth it. And really, to be on the ground, the show we did from Colorado Springs, a brand new facility there called the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, in conjunction with Rocky Mountain PBS. They hosted us there. And in this town that is so immersed in the worst consequences of our war culture, we tried to cobble together a live broadcast and did, I think, some effective and important reporting from that important kind of center of, the Army, the Air Force Academy, Fort Carson, and the consequences of PTSD. We have a whole chapter in here dedicated to that issue. So I'll let you read that. The book is it's over 300 pages, and it's just hitting the stores now. And it was a little delayed at our request. It was at the printers. And because we have a very capable nonprofit publisher called Haymarket Books, that's a good friend, Anthony Arnov, who's been here in Santa Fe quite a bit, is part of that team. We asked them to delay. It was at the printers, and we said, can you hold off for a little bit? We were writing a column about the massacre in Aurora, Colorado. And so the folks at Haymarket said, we can make that happen. It had already been laid out and indexed, and if you know how books are made, it couldn't really be messed with too much. And then after we submitted that one, another massacre in Wisconsin at a Sikh temple. And so we asked them to delay it once again. We had been in Spain. Amy was invited to speak at an event commemorating the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Guernica or Guernica, as it's commonly known, and the city that was bombed in the middle of the Spanish Civil War. Francisco Franco had asked his friends in the German Luftwaffe to bomb the city as an example to the Basque people and others not to resist, and they destroyed this town. What we saw there, we went and visited Guernica, and the town has obviously been rebuilt, but we interviewed survivors of the bombing, people in their 90s. And the interesting detail that you don't always learn is that the town was famously destroyed, the full market with the people and the animals and the horses. That's what Picasso made famous. But the rail line that bisects the town was untouched, and several buildings that abut the rail line on the other side were also untouched, and those were weapons plants. They made munitions, and then there was a pistol factory that was very important, made state-of-the-art semi-automatic pistols that were very popular with the Nationalist Army. So we saw this example of small arms afflicting, the salvation of those buildings and the destruction of the people and the residences in this early example of what we hear too often now coming out of the Pentagon spokespeople and mimicked by the corporate press, the strategic bombing. It was an early example of that. And so to see that, we wrote one of the columns. I'll just quickly share it with you, if I could. It's the last one in the book, and again, we had to squeeze these in at the very end, and thanks to Haymarket for doing that. It's called 75 Years Later, The Lessons of Guernica. 75 years ago, the Spanish town of Guernica was bombed into rubble. The brutal act propelled one of the world's great artists into a three-week painting frenzy. Pablo Picasso's Guernica starkly depicts the horrors of war etched into the faces of the people and the animals on the 20-by-30-foot canvas. It would not prove to be the worst attack during the Spanish Civil War, but it became the most famous through the power of art. The impact of the thousands of bombs dropped on Guernica, of the aircraft, machine guns, strafing civilians trying to flee the inferno, is still felt to this day by the elderly survivors who will eagerly share their vivid memories, as well as by Guernica's youth who are struggling to forge a future for their town out of its painful history. The German Luftwaffe's Condor Legion did the bombing at the request of General Francisco Franco, who led a military rebellion against Spain's democratically elected government. Franco enlisted the help of Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, who were eager to practice modern techniques of warfare on the defenseless citizens of Spain. The bombing of Guernica was the first complete destruction by aerial bombardment of a civilian city in European history. While homes and shops were destroyed, several arms manufacturing facilities, along with a key bridge and the rail line, were left intact. Spry and alert at 89, Luis Iriondo Arturna, this is a Basque word, it's Arturna Teixeira, sat down with Amy in the offices of Guernica Gogoratuz, which means remembering Guernica in the Basque language. Basque is an ancient language and is central to the fierce independence of Basque-speaking people who have lived for millennia in the region that straddles the border of Spain and France. Luis was 14 and working as an assistant at a local bank when Guernica was bombed. It was market day, so the town was full, the market square packed with people and animals. The bombing started at 4:30 p.m. on April 26, 1937. Luis recalled, "It went on for 3.5 hours. When the bombing ended, I left the shelter and I saw all of the town burning. Everything was on fire." Luis and others fled uphill to the nearby village of Lumo, where, as night fell, they saw their hometown burning, saw their homes collapse in the flames. They were given a space to sleep in a barn. Luis continued, "I don't remember if it was at midnight or at another time, as I did not own a watch at the time. I heard someone calling me. In the background, you could see Guernica on fire. And thanks to the light of the fire, I realized that it was my mother. She had found my other three siblings. I was the last one to be found." Luis and his family were war refugees for many years, eventually returning to Guernica, where he still lives and works, as did Picasso in Paris, as a painter. Luis took us to his studio, its walls covered with paintings. most prominent was the one he painted of that moment in Lumo when his mother found him. We asked him how he felt at that moment. His eyes welled. He apologized and said he couldn't speak of it. Just blocks away stands one of the arms factories that avoided destruction. It was the plant where chemical weapons and pistols were made. It is called the Astra Building. While Astra has moved away, the weapons company maintains its connection to the town by naming its various automatic weapons the Guernica, designed, quote, by warriors for warriors. Several years ago, young people occupied the vacant plant, demanding it be turned into a cultural center. Oyer Plaza was a young activist from Guernica who told us, "At first, the police threw us out, and then we occupied it again. And finally, the town hall bought the building, and then we started this process to recover the building and to create the Astra Project. The aim of the Astra Project is to convert this weapons plant into a cultural center with classes in art, video, and other media production. We have to look to the past to understand the present, to create a better future. And I think Astra is part of that process. It is the past, it is the present, and it is the future of this town," young Oyer Plaza told us. From Picasso's Guernica to Luis Iriondo Arteche's self-portrait with his mother, to the efforts of Oyer Plaza and his young friends, the power of art to turn swords into plowshares to resist war is perennially renewed. That's the last column that we managed to get in the book before printing it and bringing it here to you. I'm just a little over, but I would be remiss. Amy was very happy that an old, dear friend of hers contributed the foreword to the book. And my efforts to introduce her, although I've been a colleague, a friend, and of hers for 12 or more years now. But this person's known her for closer to 30, and I'll just introduce him. He's better known now as a filmmaker, but back then he hadn't yet released his first film. So here's the foreword to the book written by Michael Moore. And then he writes, and I'll be quick, "I first met Amy Goodman in the first month of the first Palestinian Intifada. It's where I usually go to meet people. You throw an Intifada, I'm there." And so is Amy. In fact, if you're in the middle of any sort of rebellion, revolution, uprising, or you're just getting the familiar everyday ass-whooping by forces that seem much greater than yours, that is where you'll find the fearless Amy Goodman. It's safe to say that she lives by the promise Tom Joad made to his mother at the end of Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. "I'll be everywhere. Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. If there's one thing you can trust, it's that Amy Goodman will always be there." The weeks we spent together in the West Bank and Gaza were, to say the least, quite harrowing. And yet they had a profound impact on both of us. It was just after Christmas, 1987, and the Palestinian people had decided to rise up and resist their Israeli minders with protests, civil disobedience, and stones. Stones! Ah, remember the days of stones? Such an innocent time it was back then. Ralph Nader had asked a group of us, mostly writers and journalists, to go over to the occupied territories and bring back to the American public the truth about what was really going on. Little did we know that we would be witnessing the first weeks of what sadly is now a 25-year-long resistance. Here's the dominant image in my head of Amy Goodman during that month in Palestine. When the Israeli soldiers started firing their rubber bullets at us and a group of unarmed Palestinians, we would all run the other way, i.e. away from the bullets. And Amy Goodman would be running the opposite way, straight into the melee. She appeared as if she were invincible, and while I do not want to imply she's some sort of superhero with supernatural powers, I will say that I'm glad she's on our side, and leave it at that. 2 years later, in 1990, Amy Goodman and fellow journalist Alan Nairn traveled to East Timor to cover their independence movement, and it was there that she personally witnessed the murder and massacre of 270 Timorese civilians by the Indonesian army. And for bearing witness to this horrific event, she and Alan were beaten by the army officials. I cannot imagine what it would be like to be present while 270 people are being killed, but there was Amy again on the front lines searching out the truth. and at great personal risk. Amy's daily television and radio show, Democracy Now!, is currently in its 16th year. How on earth she and her remarkable team pull this together day after day is beyond me. When I did a weekly TV show, I wanted to throw myself into the East River at the end of every week. And just as an aside, Jeremy Scahill worked on a season of The Awful Truth with Michael. And when I lived in Boston, my phone rang, and Jeremy's like, can you get a big group up to New Hampshire tomorrow morning? I was like, sure, probably. What's going on? I was like, well, Michael Moore, he wants to create this mosh pit in front of a Steve Forbes campaign event. And if you know what a mosh pit is, it's like you play really loud punk music and people slam into each other. You got like 50 or more people. And so we managed. And this was on the heels of the Iowa mosh pit, where Michael Moore said he would endorse any Republican candidate in the Iowa primaries who would jump into his mosh pit. I don't know if you remember that, but Alan Keyes did do that and ultimately gained that important endorsement. But, you know, it was cold in New Hampshire. Lots of things were going wrong, but we were in front of this AM radio station, and Steve Forbes was being interviewed inside. Everyone's moshing away, and we could see, I think he got it on video, the image of Steve Forbes running out the back of the radio station through the snow-covered woods was worth it. So, gonna love it. So that was Michael's frustration. I witnessed it firsthand on that one episode. But so Michael says, I've been on her show many times and have seen backstage the incredible professional operation that they have over there in downtown Manhattan. I don't know if they give tours like they do at NBC, but I would put the Democracy Now! Headquarters on any intelligent tourists must-see list. And I know firsthand there are intelligent tourists in this room who've already gone on that Democracy Now! Tour. So you're all invited. Just not all at once. Back in early 1988, as we traveled the back roads of the West Bank, going from one village to another, there was much that we saw that would make even the most committed among us give up hope, beset with the knowledge that true justice seemed like a faraway destination. After all, this was a struggle between a massive military machine that had nuclear weapons and children with slingshots. Who wins that fight? Well, there was a day a long, long time ago that an oppressed people had a young boy with a slingshot, and that boy used that slingshot, and for that, his people would be free. So we didn't leave Palestine in total despair. In fact, we were deeply inspired by the will and determination of the people we met, people who had nothing, people who were in it for the long haul and had no intention of giving up. It was a good lesson for us to learn. It would be another 2 years before I'd release my first film, Roger and Me, and it would be 8 more years before Democracy Now! Would go on the air. We became committed to doing our best with the slingshots we have. And so with those very kind and humorous and insightful words of Michael Moore, I just ask you to join me in welcoming Amy Goodman to the stage.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Oh, thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be here, to be back home in New Mexico. That's what it feels like. And thank you to the Lannan Foundation, to Patrick Lannan and Andy Tuck, to Lori Betlock, to Barbara Ventrello, the whole team that brings so many wonderful cultural and political events to Santa Fe. And I want to thank my colleagues who are here, Karen Renucci, who is the chair of our board, and Dennis Moynihan, who has been, well, without whom this book would not have been possible. This 100-city tour would not have been possible. Maybe that would have been a good... No, I actually really, really enjoy it. I'm not sure what number we're up to. I think it's around 50. And I said that to someone recently, and they said, oh, you only have like 50 to go then? I thought that was a very negative comment. Is there a chance we could lift up the lights a little bit here? Because it is such a treat to be able to actually see people's faces. It's sort of why we come out around the country. It's a little more, let there be light. It is wonderful to do that. I thought I'd start with a joke. My brother sent this to me, my older brother Steve, and he was at High Holy Day Services, and the rabbi shared it. It's a true story. Commander Horatio Hornblower was on the deck of his ship and saw a light ahead. This is the exchange that followed. Boat number one to approaching light. We are on a collision course. Turn your boat 10 degrees north. Light signals back. Yes, you're on a collision course. Please turn your boat 10 degrees south. Boat one signals again. I'm an admiral. I'm commanding you to turn your boat 10 degrees north. Light flashes back immediately. I am a seaman second class, and I'm telling you to turn your boat 10 degrees south. The admiral is furious. He flashes back. I repeat, I am a Navy admiral, and you are hereby ordered to turn your boat 10 degrees north. I am in a battleship. Light returns a signal, and I am commanding you to turn your boat 10 degrees south. I am in a lighthouse. That's kind of the way our dining room table sounded every night. We would share jokes with my parents, my three brothers, and battle out the key issues of the day. Learning to fight, learning to love. I see community media as an extension of that. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day: war and peace, life and death. And anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. Anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country who can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us in civilian society to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they live or die, whether they are sent to kill or be killed. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. And so last Friday on this 100-city tour, as Dennis described, we broadcast from Colorado Springs, and we brought you David Phillips, who wrote Lethal Warriors. That was the name of a unit that went to Iraq, came back, went to Iraq again, came back, and did not figure out how to turn off the kill button. And they hear at Fort Carson the murder rate 114 times surrounding Colorado Springs. They were killing their girlfriends, their wives, other soldiers, strangers. You could only imagine what they were doing in Iraq. But here, it is called a crime as it should be, and as it should be there. On this 11th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, we have to show the reality of war. We were also joined by Andrew Pagani. He counsels soldiers now in the Colorado Springs, Denver area. He served in Iraq. In the first few days, he had been given Larium, the anti-malaria drug, and he also had seen a Bradley tank explode in Iraqi, and he couldn't take it. He broke down, and he told his commanding officer he needed help, and he's the first soldier since Vietnam to be charged with cowardice. Cowardice. If a soldier is found guilty of cowardice, he can face the death penalty. Astounding. He was exonerated. But what does this say about our society? I then headed back to Colorado on Friday, as we travel very quickly through this country, swinging through the swing states. And I should say, we were in Virginia Tech, and I don't know how many of you heard this broadcast, but we brought Colin Goddard down. Colin Goddard's with the Brady campaign against gun violence now. He was leading a campaign to get Jim Lehrer, the moderator of the first presidential debate at the University of Denver, to ask a question about gun violence. After all, the candidates were in Colorado, where Aurora had just taken place, and of course, about a decade ago, the Columbine shootings had taken place. It only made sense. And Colin Goddard came down to Virginia Tech, where he survived the shooting in 2007. He was shot four times, twice in the hips and in his shoulders. He was going to French class in the morning. He took us through Norris Hall, where the shootings occurred. And he didn't want to go to class, he said, the day he had French class at 9. He was deciding, oh, should I go to breakfast or should I go to French class? And, well, he ended up late in French class, his French professor rolling her eyes as usual. Colin rolls in late. But then Colin was even surprised that a half hour later, the best student in the class, Rachel, came in. Never before had she come into class after Colin. And she was rather flustered and said, I'm so sorry. There was a shooting in my dorm this morning and the authorities wouldn't let us out or I would have come earlier. And she sat down and then they heard the crackle of gunshot. And they didn't know what it was. They thought it might be construction outside. And then they heard it again, and the French professor looked out the door, a young woman, and she raced back in. She told everyone to get under their chairs, and she was one of the first killed, the shooter moving in. And they all fell under their table, their desks, and Colin, for the first time in his life, took out his Nextel phone and dialed 911 and said quickly, Norris Hall, there's been a shooting. Please come quickly. They said, Norris Hall, where? And he said, Norris Hall, Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech, where? He said, Virginia Tech in Blacksburg. Quickly, I don't have time. There's a shooting. There's been shooting, and it's continuing. And they said, Blacksburg, where? And he said, Blacksburg, Virginia, please. Virginia? Not clear if it was in this country or another country, the response. But eventually, as he and others were being shot and killed in the classroom, they were able to connect him and they reached the police and somehow the phone was shot out of his hand or he lost control of it and he found out after that the young woman next to him under her desk was holding it and whispering the whole time and he described all of this and he was walking down this hallway. The rest of this building is the typical, you know, cinder block and tile, but this hallway they've changed. It's wood flooring and is now the center for peace and nonviolence. And before I talked to Colin, I went to see the wonderful poet Nikki Giovanni, the university distinguished professor, and I sat with her in her office. I've wanted to meet her for a long time and interviewed her. I knew she doesn't talk about the shooting, but I talked to her about her work, her life. She's putting together this wonderful tribute to Toni Morrison because her son Slade died, who she dedicated Sula to. And she said, me and the doc are honoring Toni. And I said, who's the doc? She said, well, that would be Dr. Maya Angelou. And in October, they're going to have this wonderful event at Virginia Tech. And we were talking about all these things and her poetry and her literature. And then I asked her about the Virginia Tech shooting. And she said, oh, I was in San Francisco. And I didn't know anything about anything going to happen. But she said, I raced back to Virginia. Nothing had happened. She just said, I'd come for a meeting, and I told everyone I got to go. I had no idea why I said that. They didn't know either. And she said, I raced back to Virginia, and I got out of the airport, and I'm driving down the highway, and I see the local TV crew driving about 125 miles an hour past me, and I see the police at the Blacksburg exit won't let anyone through. And she says, and I move on, and I'm turning on the radio, and I realize something terrible has happened. And I said, that must be Cho, she said. Cho, her poetry student. She immediately knew Cho. She had taught him poetry, and this is so incredibly sad, well before this massacre. And she said she could not reach him. His sunglasses on in class were a woke cap over his face. He wouldn't talk. He wouldn't respond. She said to him, I want you out of my class. He said, you can't make me go. She said, you're right, and so if you don't go, I resign. And she said that to the head of the department. And she understood it wasn't the right thing that she can't force someone else. Should I taught kids with Tourette's? I taught kids with autism. I taught very difficult kids. And I loved all of them. She said, but this was a serious problem. And clearly, the university just did not deal with this. I say she didn't say that. Even Colin Goddard talked about how the university, you know, this kid who had been stalking women, he had been institutionalized, and yet the university did not take note. And this is why Colin Goddard says the fact that he had a legal gun, and the same with Aurora, we have to change the culture in this country. And so we headed to Washington and then flew to Denver. We're in Colorado Springs, all levels of violence, whether it's abroad or here at home. And then when I came back to Denver, I was invited on Al Jazeera English to have a conversation with David Weston, who is the president of ABC World News Tonight for many years, all through the, from 2001 or two, right through to 2010. And we were talking about the elections and war, and he said the media is fair, the media brings out all points of view. And I said, but Mr. Weston, let's go back to 2003, right? Let's go back to the invasion of Iraq. Let's go back to that two-week period around Colin Powell giving his push for war at the United Nations and the Secretary of State, General Colin Powell. Fair did the study of the four major nightly newscasts, ABC, World News Tonight, your newscast, 2 weeks, 6 weeks before the invasion, CBS Evening News, NBC Nightly News, and the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. There were 393 interviews done around this two-week period, a critical period when, as Noam Chomsky says, the media manufactures consent for war. 393 interviews done around war. Guess how many were with anti-war leaders? Three. Three of almost 400. That is no longer a mainstream media. That is an extreme media beating the drums for war. And David Weston said, you might be surprised, Amy, to know that I agree with you. I was very surprised. And he said that he will forever regret that when Peter Jennings was alive, you know, he was the news anchor of ABC World News Tonight, he had grave doubts about the evidence around weapons of mass destruction, but David Weston told him to hold back. And he said, we were under a lot of pressure. That's why we need independent media. Because I really do think that those who are deeply concerned about war, President Obama presiding over the longest war in U.S. history, those who are concerned about the increasing inequality in this country, those who are concerned about climate change, about the forest fires in Colorado, the drenching rains in Florida, the Dust Bowl conditions of the Midwest. Those who are concerned about the fate of the planet are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. We need a media that covers movements. You know, I originally come from Pacifica Radio, which was founded more than 60 years ago in Berkeley, California. War Resister came out of World War II and said there's got to be a media outlet that is not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. The first Pacifica station, KPFA in Berkeley, 1949. Or as George Gerbner, the late dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, said, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell that are raising our children today. KPFK, the second station in Los Angeles, 59, my station, BAI in New York, 1960, WPFW, 1977, KPFT, 1970. It went on the air and was the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up by the Ku Klux Klan. They strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it to smithereens. And when they got back on their feet, in the middle of Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant on KPFT, and I think that's a good song, they blew it up again. I don't know if it was the exalted Cyclops, the grand dragon, or the imperial wizard, because I often confuse their titles, but he said it was his proudest act. I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is, how dangerous KSFR and KUNM and KZRA and public access TV and satellite television as well, free speech TV and Link TV, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, if only we could hear speaking today, Rachel Corrie, the young American peace activist who decided she would leave Evergreen, her college in Olympia, Washington, and go to Gaza to try to help, to try to build a bridge, to try to in some way contribute to peace. And she heard that Sunday morning, Israeli military bulldozer was coming up and going to demolish the home of a family she cared deeply about, had spent a lot of time with a husband, pharmacist. And she went out and she put on one of those orange construction vests that are fluorescent so that she could be seen, and brought out a bullhorn, and with a few other peace activists stood there. And the Israeli military bulldozer made by Caterpillar here in the United States crushed Rachel Corrie twice, drove over her, and then drove back over her. She died March 16, 2003, under the bulldozer. It was 3 days before the invasion of Iraq, just at the Republican convention where we did our broadcast from in Tampa and then in Charlotte. We interviewed Cindy and Craig Corrie once again, her parents from Haifa. They had sued the Israeli military. They didn't win this round. A judge ruled against them. It wasn't that surprising to them, but they will appeal. I mean, they are looking at the long haul, and they are trying to carry out Rachel Corrie's peace activism. Ah, how the daughters, how the children teach the elders. And that's the path her parents have chosen. If only we could hear Rachel Corrie, but also an Afghan aunt, an Iraqi uncle. People speaking for themselves. There's nothing more powerful. People speaking from their own experience. That's why independent media is important, because it breaks down bigotry, challenges the stereotypes and the caricatures that fuel the hate groups. You know, tonight, after this talk, we'll head to Los Alamos, and we're going to be broadcasting from Fuller Lodge, one of the original buildings of the Manhattan Project. We'll broadcast there in the morning, then do an event about 11:30 as well from Fuller Lodge. And I think about World War II, the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, who was handed the target list for possible Japanese cities to bomb, the first atomic bombs to be dropped in the world that were made just down the road from here, from Los Alamos. And Henry Stimson looked at the list. It said Hiroshima, it said Nagasaki, and it said Kyoto, and he immediately crossed off Kyoto because he and Mrs. Stimson had visited Kyoto. They loved the people. They thought it was a beautiful city, the art memorable, and the food delicious. And he said, no, we wouldn't want to destroy that city. If only the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki had gotten a chance to host the Stimsons as well. I mean, think about it. And think about the profound lesson we learn from this. He knew this place, and so he didn't want to destroy it. That's the power of independent media. You come to know, not necessarily agree with that husband in Pakistan or the child in Venezuela, not necessarily agree, but you hear what they have to say, or the kid in the South Bronx. You begin to find common ground. It's the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, it is wielded as a weapon of war. And that has to be changed. That has to be challenged. So going from World War II and the destruction of these cities and what in fact we can actually build, I find greatest hope in movements. I mean, what we have seen in the last years is remarkable. I mean, this last year, the Arab Spring, it begins with Tunisia. A young Tunisian named Mohamed Bouazizi comes out of the university and he has no opportunity, goes to sell vegetables and fruit in the marketplace. He's being harassed by the authorities. They take his scale. And he is so utterly frustrated, he sets himself on fire. And it ignites the frustration of a generation in Tunisia. That act fueled the Arab Spring. And there was something else as well. I would say it was WikiLeaks, the whistleblower website that released so many millions of documents overall, whether the Iraq war logs or the Afghan war logs or the State Department cables for many decades. Why did this play a role? Well, it's not as if the Tunisians didn't know their dictator Ben Ali was corrupt and brutal. But these documents, particularly around Tunisia, showed that the U.S. government knew as well, but they were funding Ben Ali and supporting him to the tune of millions of dollars every year. And it just increased their frustration. And the same went for Mubarak. And Tunisia ignited Egypt. And Egypt, well, how many of you experienced the Egyptian revolution through the reporting of my wonderful colleague, Sharif Abdelkaddous, who left the United States that week of January 5th, 2011. He flew basically directly into Tahrir. He was getting texts from his family, from his friends. They were saying, I will die for my country. And he was saying, no, these friends aren't political. What are they talking about? This country, my country, is changing. Sharif is the son of an illustrious family, his grandfather, the most famous writer of Egypt, Hassan Abdelkaddous. And Sharif flew into Tahrir. And he didn't leave virtually for 18 days. You know, Mubarak had plunged the country into digital darkness. He turned off the internet. Actually, he used a U.S. company to do that, NARUS, which was based in California. And when there was this global outcry, the next day, NARUS put out a press release saying we're only following orders, which we've heard before. And Sharif figured out a way around the digital blockade, and he became one of the top tweeters in the world. You know, Democracy Now! From 16 years ago when we began, it's our sweet 16, we began on a few dozen community radio stations around the country. Then September 11th, that week, we started on one emergency broadcasting for one TV station in New York City, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and then the show just took off. TV stations all over the country asked for it soon. I didn't think we should snail mail it, so we were FedExing these video cassettes with huge garbage bags filled with video cassettes that the FedEx guy would pick up every day. And we didn't quite have the money to use satellites, but we certainly used the internet, pioneering a way to send broadcast quality video through the internet. And of course, we did that with radio as well. The internet has been integral to our growth from the beginning. You know, we have to make sure that we keep the internet open and free and not let the cable companies and the telecoms write the legislation that would privatize this global resource. The corporations have been globalizing for years. The internet is the way that we can most effectively do grassroots globalization around the world. And it shouldn't be a time when you go to att.com or google.com and it comes up right away, democracynow.org, maybe 10 minutes later, and a Dalit Indian women's website never coming up at all. We cannot allow that. We must increase communication, not let them shut it down. And so here was Sharif in the middle of Tahrir. They brought down the internet. He is in Tahrir, and then they bring it back up, but then the thugs take down the satellites. Now, the networks aren't used to this. Now, we have been sending broadcast quality video through the internet for a long time. We use satellites as well, but we also use the internet. I remember seeing Anderson Cooper and it's through a sort of fuzzy Skype in his hotel room in the lower third, said, reporting from an undisclosed location, looking sort of like old Democracy Now. And there was Sharif in the middle of Tahrir interviewing Hadef Suef, the great Egyptian writer who wrote Map of Love, Nawal al-Sadawi, the writer, the psychiatrist, the former presidential candidate. She'd been imprisoned under Sadat. She'd been exiled under Mubarak. She had been holding salons before Tahrir, telling young people, even through all the suffering she'd been through, we will win, even as they became increasingly dispirited. You met the young high school student who was putting out a broadsheet that said Voices of Tahrir in the shadow of the state media building that had spewed lies for so long. These were the interviews that Sharif was doing as he was making his way through Tahrir, and he was with Hani Massoud, our amazing video producer, who can leap tall buildings in a single bound. He was played on the equivalent of the Egyptian national basketball team. And he was with Sharif every step of the way, videoing these interviews and then jumping over the burning barricades, getting around those camels that were crushing people, making his way back to Sharif's family house to put together these video broadcasts, 20, 25 minutes of all these remarkable people that you would meet speaking for themselves the next day on Democracy Now! And sending them through the internet at night. And there was Sharif continually in the middle of Tahrir, who was being interviewed by NBC and MSNBC and CNN, all the networks, of course, on Democracy Now! We call that trickle-up journalism. And then the Egyptian Revolution fueled the Arab Spring, which I think also inspired Wisconsin. What happened in Wisconsin last year? It was historic, the largest protest Wisconsin has ever seen. I mean, Governor Walker also contributed to the inspiration. That's Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who, after he was elected, tried to eviscerate the public unions, particularly targeting teachers, and to destroy their collective bargaining rights. So, of course, Democracy Now! Covers grassroots movements. So we flew into Madison as people were taking over the Capitol building, and we broadcast from there. And I remember walking through there and seeing some of the biggest guys I'd ever seen in my life. They're the Oshkosh prison guards, all tattooed, and they were standing in a corner. And I went over to them. I said, "Who'd you vote for?" And they said, "Governor Walker, of course." So I said, "So what are you doing here?" And they said, "Protesting Governor Walker, of course." And I said, "Why?" And they said, "Because he didn't tell us he was going to do this, go after our wives and our neighbors. No, this is not the way it's going to be." And then I saw these amazing scenes in front of Governor Walker's office. You had kids with their dreads. They were drumming away, and the police were rocking out next to them. Because the police and the firefighters were joining with the teachers and the nurses, saying although Governor Walker assured the police he was not going after them, they said, if they're going after our neighbors, if they're going after our partners and our daughters, they are going after us. And they knew they would be next anyway. It was an amazing scene. They would all be sleeping in the state capitol. I mean, I walked outside, 150,000 people one day in the freezing cold in the snow. They continued to march. And I saw this older gentleman with glasses on carrying a sign marching with everyone else. It said IRS auditors against Walker. And then I went up in a crane to get this amazing bird's eye view, and I see the History Museum across the way and know about the University of Wisconsin Labor Archive. And especially for young people here, for high school and college students, if you think, well, today the struggles, they're not so clear cut, but like when Dr. King was there, that was straightforward. We knew what was right and what was wrong. Well, think again, because, you know, AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, was founded in Wisconsin in 1932. Martin Luther King died in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, 1968. Why had he gone to Memphis? Simply to march with sanitation workers who were trying to organize a local, 1707, of AFSCME. Yes, it's all a continuation. There was another organization that was born in Wisconsin. It was the John Birch Society. You know that the John Birch Society was co-founded by Fred Koch, the father of David and Charles Koch. And this is an interesting story to tell. Right at the beginning of the Republican convention, right before it started, I attended a talk of Michael Cranish, who is a Boston Globe reporter, and he wrote a biography of Mitt Romney. And he told the story back in 1964, Mitt's father, Governor George Romney, a popular governor from Michigan, people were trying to draft him to run for president against Barry Goldwater. He'd only been governor for 2 years. He talked to his wife and his kids and to Mitt Romney, who was a high school student. And he went to the Republican convention and took Mitt with him. And he didn't run that year. He despised Barry Goldwater. He gave a speech before the Republican Platform Committee. He was horrified that Goldwater wouldn't support the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And he said, hate and extremism will destroy this party. And he singled out the John Birch Society. You know, when he left there, he wouldn't endorse Barry Goldwater, which is not like the politic thing to do. You may disagree with a fellow party member, but in the end, you're supposed to endorse. And when Goldwater was enraged and wanted to know why, he sent him a many-page letter saying he'd never endorse him. He wouldn't endorse the hate. And then you just jump forward a couple of decades, and the son of Governor George Romney is shaking hands with and being funded by the sons of the co-founder of the John Birch Society. Just an interesting story. And you go from Wisconsin then to Occupy. Well, no, let's go a few weeks before Occupy. Remember when thousands of environmentalists went to Washington, D.C. and formed a ring around the Rose Garden, demanding that President Obama stop the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline from going from Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico. 1,200 of them were arrested. And then they came up to New York. And September 17th was a very big deal. You know, thousands of people marched on Zuccotti Park and they occupied and they started the whole Occupy Wall Street encampment. And I remember the corporate media very well. First silence, first day, second day, third day, fourth. I mean, Occupy Wall Street was right in the middle of New York, right by Wall Street. This is the media metropolis of the world. They certainly knew this was happening. I mean, it took more than a week. And then they start ridiculing, right? Then they start saying, who are these people? And what do they want? And can't they get it together to get a spokesperson? And every different issue under the sun, you see all their signs. I mean, what are they trying to say? Really? What were they trying to say? I think any Madison Avenue PR exec would have drooled to be the one credited with the perhaps the most successful slogan in U.S. history. We are the 99%. You know, it may have been hard for these pundits to understand. These pundits on all the networks who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. But it wasn't hard for the rest of America to understand across the political spectrum. It reverberated. It resonated. I mean, Occupy occupied the language, not only in English, but in languages all over the world. But, you know, Mahatma Gandhi said it best. First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win. And, I mean, the Occupy encampment. Okay, so let's see. Egyptians and many others were calling in orders to the local pizzerias in New York to send to the Occupy encampment to feed the people there. And the people who were occupying were certainly conservationist, along with everything else. And they were using every aspect of these pizza pies that were sent in. Of course, they called them Occupies. And they would eat them, and actually they would serve them in these big buffets. You know, hundreds of people would line up, and I would go down there, you know, at lunchtime, and I would see the bankers who were lined up too. This is right next to Wall Street. You know, they heard there was a free lunch. So, and then they would take the boxes when they were done, and they would make signs out of them. In the middle of October, there was this freak snowstorm, you know, going to the issue of climate change, and they cleared all the signs away. They didn't want them to get soggy, and they all went under their tarps and encampments, and they put up one sign, hell, snow, we won't go. And what were some of the other signs? They said things like, I'll believe a corporation is a person when Texas executes one. There were a lot of signs. I am Troy Davis and too much doubt. You know, we forget what movements fueled these massive changes. And we must not, and we need a media that documents this, right? Because journalism is the first draft of history. It is very important. I am Troy Davis. Who was Troy Davis? September 17th was the first day of the encampment. September 21st, 2011, Troy Davis was slated to die. And I want to just read you from one of the columns that Dennis and I wrote about Troy Davis and the machinery of death. On September 21st at 7 p.m., Troy Anthony Davis was scheduled to die. We were reporting live from outside Georgia's death row in Jackson, Georgia, awaiting news about whether the Supreme Court would spare his life. Davis was sentenced to death for the murder of off-duty Savannah police officer Mark McPhail in 1989. McPhail was a hero cop. He was moonlighting for like Burger King or something, and there was a homeless man being pistol whipped in the parking lot late at night, and he went to his rescue and he was shot dead, and whoever killed him should be punished. The question was, who killed him? Seven of the nine non-police witnesses later recanted or changed their testimony, some alleging police intimidation for their original false statements. One who didn't recant was the man who many have named as the actual killer, who showed up at the police station soon after the murder with his lawyer pointing the finger at Troy Davis. No physical evidence linked Davis to the shooting. Davis was one of more than 3,200 prisoners on death row in the United States. He'd faced three prior execution dates. With each one, Global Awareness Group, Amnesty International, and the NAACP all called for clemency. The Pope called for clemency. The former FBI Director William Sessions, the former Republican Congressmember from Georgia, Bob Barr. The former prison warden of this death row prison, Alan Ault, and five other prison wardens, they weren't against the death penalty. But they said not for Troy Davis. Too much doubt. So we headed down to the prison grounds. If we could have broadcast from the execution chamber, I would have. Because most people in this country don't realize how alone we are. The United States is the only industrialized country in the world to execute the death penalty. If this is done in our name, we should see what happens. But we couldn't, you know, broadcast from the execution chamber, but we were going to broadcast from the prison grounds. And when we got there, I was with Hani Massoud, who covered the Egyptian Revolution. Renee Feltz, who's our reporter from Texas, who's long covered death row cases. I was just on the phone with her before this talk as we plan our show tomorrow in Los Alamos. And Mike Burke, our senior producer, and we were there. And we'd hired a truck, a satellite truck. You know, you gotta do this to cover these cases. I soon learned, you know, Fox would have them the day before and CNN would hire them the next day. And the Department of Corrections said we couldn't go near the protest pen. It was roped in. They'd allow 150 people, 1,000 people were across the state, across the street, like, oh, the historically black colleges of Spelman and Morehouse. The students had marched from Atlanta, 1,000 people holding candles. They said we couldn't go near the protest pen. Now, we were going to do a many-hour broadcast. Who knew what would happen with Troy Davis? Three other death warrants had been vacated in the case of Troy Davis. But we were going to be there for the long haul. But I wasn't planning to speak for 6 hours. I mean, we are there to go to where the silence is. We are there to speak to people who don't usually get heard. And this protest pen, I think, was a good example. The family of Troy Davis there, human rights leaders as well, people from around the world. And I look over at the elite journalists who are sort of on the edges of the prison grounds. I'm thinking, why aren't they giving any pushback here? I mean, they're accepting that we're not allowed to talk to anyone. But, you know, if they're just going to broadcast for 30 or 60 seconds, it's not that hard to fill that time. So our truck comes onto the grounds. It was a little late. The other trucks had, you know, followed orders and gone back there. And the truck drivers, bigger than the Oshkosh prison guards, said to me, "Miss Goodman, where do you want to broadcast?" And I'm looking nervously over at the prison guards. I said, "Well, I mean, they said, where do you want to broadcast?" I said, "Well, I would like to broadcast over by that protest pen." And they just barreled the truck over to the pen. And the guards are coming over, but they're a little nervous. You know, sometimes it pays to work with the big boys because it really makes a difference. So they said, where on this line do you want to stand? I said, well, I was actually right in the middle, hoping to be right there. They set up the orange cones and they put me in the middle and they gave me a mic and they said, start broadcasting. And so our broadcast began. Oh, we were given a press packet from the Department of Corrections, very thin. It mainly, it talks about Troy Davis's schedule for the last day of his life. It said that he would be able to see his family from 9 to 3, but then they had to clear out for a routine physical. Routine physical. You know what happened a while ago? In Texas, a man on death row attempted suicide. They raced him to the hospital, got him better, and then they executed him. Routine physical. Oh, and they also went into detail, this press packet, with what Troy Davis would be having for dinner. He turned down the special meal. The press kit described the standard tray Davis would be offered. Grilled cheeseburgers, oven brown potatoes, baked beans, coleslaw, cookies, and a grape beverage. And then they gave a second page that was four lines, big letters, like when you go to the eye doctor's office and they're testing your vision on one piece of paper. It said on the first line, pentobarbital. Then under it, pancuronium bromide. Yes, they were describing the lethal cocktail that would follow. Pentobarbital, pancuronium bromide, potassium chloride, Ativan, a sedative on the fourth line. The pentobarbital anesthetizes, the pancuronium bromide paralyzes, the potassium chloride stops the heart. Davis refused the sedative and the Last Supper. By 7 p.m., the U.S. Supreme Court was reportedly reviewing Davis's plea for a stay. The case was referred to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who hails from Pinpoint, Georgia, a community founded by freed slaves that's near Savannah, where Davis had lived. The chorus for clemency grew ever louder. The Supreme Court, though, denied the plea. Davis's execution began at 10:53 p.m., a prison spokesperson delivered the news to the reporters outside. Time of death, 11:08 p.m. The eyewitnesses to the execution stepped out. You know how what the prison, the death row protocol is for the execution. They lay the prisoner out on a cross-like gurney. They strap him down. They put him before a glass window. They pull the curtains back. The family of the murder victim is there. The people that the prisoner wants may be there, and reporters are there. According to an Associated Press reporter who was there, these were Troy Davis's last words. I'd like to address the McPhail family, let you know I'm not the one who killed your son, your father, your brother. I'm innocent. The incident that happened that night is not my fault. I did not have a gun. All I can ask is that you look deeper into this case so that you really can finally see the truth. He said, I ask my family and friends to continue to fight this fight. And then he turned to his executioners and he said, for those about to take my life, God have mercy on your souls. God bless your souls. The state of Georgia took Davis's body to Atlanta for an autopsy, charging his family for the transportation. On Troy Davis's death certificate, the cause of death is listed simply as homicide. As we stood on the grounds of the prison just after Troy Davis was executed, the Department of Corrections threatened to pull the plug on our broadcast. The show was over. And I could only think about Mahatma Gandhi's response when asked what he thought of Western civilization. He responded, I think it would be a good idea. But these movements are so important. Connecticut just became the 17th or 18th state to say no to the death penalty, and it is only gaining momentum. And now I want to talk about the elections that are coming up, right? 2012. Let's go back for a moment to November 2008. When Barack Obama was elected. But before I do that, I want to talk about one issue that I am deeply concerned about, And that is the militarization of police and the crackdown on dissent in this country. And it relates to what we have to deal with today. It is an extremely serious issue. You know, we have a law in this country, Posse Comitatus Act, that says that we don't think it's a good idea for U.S. soldiers to march through the streets of our country. And I think most people think that's good. But the way the authorities have gotten around this is by militarizing the police. They're not even riot cops anymore. I mean, you don't have to take it from me. Norm Stamper, the former police chief of Seattle, who tried to stamp out all dissent at the protests against the World Trade Organization in 1999, who met innocent, peaceful teachers and high school students and French farmers and doctors and nurses and people across the political spectrum who'd come to protest this supranational organization, the WTO, the World Trade Organization, that they were afraid would overthrow the laws of democratically elected legislatures. You know how, let's say Santa Fe passed some rule, not even that you would ban GMO foods, but that you want them labeled. Let's say you did this in Santa Fe. A country could file a complaint with the WTO saying that you were instituting a barrier to trade, that this was WTO illegal. So you have this supranational organization that can overturn the laws of democratically elected legislative bodies. And people were deeply concerned, you know, serving the corporations who had much more power and say in the World Trade Organization. And Norm Stamper now says, you know, he met these people who could have been his neighbors, his daughters, his sons, with such a massive amount of force. You know, police not only have shield face shields now, they have full body shields as they move in like a moving wall, separating them from the people who are simply calling for a better world. And Norm Stamper said, I mean, they had to go to other states in those few days to get more tear gas and pepper spray. They ran out. They were hitting people with rubber bullets. CNN was saying, quoting Norm Stamper, saying, no, we're not. But Indie Media came to the fore then at indiemedia.org, getting more hits than CNN.com because we were holding the rubber bullets in our hands and showing the pictures. You couldn't deny this. They arrested hundreds of people. And he said it was the worst mistake of his life. And he's now speaking out against setting up this militaristic police force in this country that is cracking down on dissent. So when we go back to just before President Obama was elected, you know, Democracy Now, of course, covers the conventions, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency, covering the conventions inside and out. So before I talk about election night in 2008, which will lead to what's happening today, I want to talk about these conventions. Mass protest at the Democratic Convention in 2008 in Denver, people protesting against war. And then it moved on to St. Paul. 10,000 people marched for peace on the first day of the Republican Convention. Remember, John McCain had just announced Sarah Palin was his running mate. They were going to start Monday afternoon their convention, 10 o'clock in the morning. 10,000 people led by soldiers, some wearing full military regalia, saying no to war, marched from the St. Paul City Hall to the XL Convention Center. And we were out there interviewing everyone. And then Nicole and Sharif, that's Nicole Salazar, a multimedia producer, Sharif Adokadus, who would go on to cover the Egyptian Revolution, went back to the TV studio to start digitizing tape for our broadcast the next day, and I went to the convention floor to interview delegates from the hottest state, from Alaska. And then I get a call from our senior producer, Mike Burke, and he says, come quickly to 7th and Jackson, because Nicole and Sharif have been beaten and bloodied and arrested by the police. I mean, this is a beautiful blue sky Labor Day. And I said, what are you talking about, Mike? He said, I'm not kidding. Get over there. I go racing out of the convention center. I was working with Rick Rowley, a fantastic journalist and videographer, you know, who does Big Noise Films and did Fourth World War and Zapatista. And we raced down the streets to 7th and Jackson and found this big parking lot, and riot police had surrounded the area. You know, I have all my convention passes on. They are top security clearance for interviewing presidents and vice presidents and Congress members. And I go up to the riot police and, you know, they could see I just come from the convention floor. And I said, you can see my credentials and I'd like to speak to your commanding officer. My colleagues, Sharif and Nicole, are inside. They're reporters like I am. They have the same credentials. We need to have them released. And it wasn't seconds before they ripped me through the police lines. They twisted my arms back. They slapped the handcuffs on, and they threw me against a car, against the wall, and onto the ground, charging me with a misdemeanor, interfering with a peace officer. If only there was a peace officer in the vicinity. And I'm desperately looking for Nicole and Sharif from my vantage point on the ground. And I do see Sharif across the parking lot, his arms behind his back. And so I demand to be brought to him finally. And we're both standing next to each other, a handcuffed, credentials around our necks. His arm is bleeding. And we are saying, you must release us now. You know we're journalists. And the Secret Service came and ripped the credentials from around our necks. So then I'm put in the police van, and that's where I see Nicole. Nicole's in the van. She's handcuffed like us. She has a press pass around her neck, and her face is bleeding. And I said, Nicole, what happened? I thought you were in the TV studio. And she said, well, we were, but then we heard a commotion outside, and I grabbed the camera and Sharif grabbed the microphone. We raced downstairs and we saw some protesters in this parking lot, but mainly I saw riot police. And she said, I was trapped against these cars. It was a parking lot, and the police came at me and they were shouting, on your face, on your face. And she was filming with one hand and the other, she was holding up her press pass and shouting back, press, press. She didn't know what hit her. From behind and in front of her, they took her down. Knee or boot in her back, they are pulling on her legs, so they're dragging her face through the gravel. And her camera fell down, and they took the battery out of it. If you were wondering what it was, they wanted to stop happening. Sharif is a very cool guy. I mean, my goodness, 2 years later, Sharif would be covering the Egyptian revolution under Mubarak. He's not arrested in Mubarak's Egypt. But here in the streets of the United States, covering a celebration of democracy, he's taken down by the police. He goes up to the police and tells them to calm down. And they take him and they throw him up against the wall. They kick him twice in the chest, bloody his arm, and they take him down. And Nicole and Sharif face PC felony riot charges, probable cause felony riot. So I'm taken to the police garage where they've erected the cages to put the protesters in. And Nicole and Sharif are taken to jail. The response to our arrest, because media activists put the video of our arrest online on YouTube, it was the most watched YouTube video of the first 2 days of the convention. It went viral. And the response, thousands of people called, faxed, tweeted in to the Twin City authorities, called in, wrote in. And within a number of hours, I was released and then Sharif and Nicole were released. I mean, to show what a difference it makes, Sharif was in a cell with the AP photographer who wasn't released when Sharif was. They arrested more than 40 reporters that week. So then I'm taken back to the convention. It's late now and the convention's over, but the networks want to talk to me about what happened. I'm in the NBC skybox and the interview is over. And an NBC reporter comes over and says, I don't get it. Why wasn't I arrested? I said, oh, were you covering the protest outside? And he said, no. So I said, well, I don't get arrested in the skybox either. I mean, it's a wonderful view, and it's really fun to look out on the convention floor. But, you know, as Woody Allen says, 90% of life is just showing up. You've got to get out there. We got to get into the corporate suites to see who's funding these conventions. We got to get onto the convention floor and interview the delegates. And we got to get out into the streets where the uninvited guests are, sometimes thousands of them. They have something important to say as well. You know, democracy is a messy thing. And it's our job to capture it all. And we shouldn't have to get a record when we put things on the record. So the next... So the next day, Police Chief Harrington held a news conference, the St. Paul Police Chief, and to talk about how successful the first day of the police operation had been. And this was very alarming to us that we had just gotten Nicole out of the emergency room. And we had a lot of work to do over these next few days. And the officer who opened the door to the news conference for me was my processing officer the night before. And I said, you not only have to let me into this news conference, you have to let me out when it's done. So I go into the news conference and reporters are raising their hands as I do. And I describe what happened to Nicole and Sharif and me. And I said, what have you instructed your officers to do, and how do you expect us to operate in this environment? And he said we could embed with a mobile field force. Embed. You know, like reporters embed in the front lines of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, in the police mobile field force. The next day I see a Fox reporter with his Fox baseball cap in the middle of this moving police organism going down the streets of St. Paul. Embed. I think the embedding process has brought the media to an all-time low. I mean, I'm not saying reporters who embed are not brave. They are. But you are sleeping with the troops, eating with the troops. Your life is in their hands. How do you think you are going to cover the war from the trigger end? You need then to have reporters embedded in Iraqi hospitals and Afghan communities and the peace movement around the world to understand the full effects of war. And the problem is not only embedding in with soldiers, but embedding in the establishment in Washington. You know, we're supposed to be apart from the parties. My brother David and I wrote the book, The Exception to the Rulers, because that's what the media should be, The Exception to the Rulers. And we wrote Static. And the reason we called it that is because the media is supposed to give us the dictionary definition of static: criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. Yes. And so we sued the Twin City authorities. We sued the police and the Secret Service. And this took a number of years, 3 years. And last year, the Minneapolis judge called us in to settle with them. We ended up with a six-figure settlement, and it was unprecedented in suing the police, the Secret Service, who demanded to be severed. But we knew it was them, though it's very hard to figure out in these special national security events just who is who. They often cover their numbers and their names. But we were lucky because it's hard to describe being lucky, but we were lucky because when we were handcuffed, demanding to be released, and they ripped the credentials from around our necks, I turned to the police officer and I said, "How dare you do that?" And he said, "Oh, that wasn't us. That was the Secret Service." So, and we got them to agree to develop a protocol for how to deal with press. And we wanted to send a message to the police. And we thought, what better place to announce this settlement than a large gathering of police? And so we came back to New York and we held a news conference at Occupy Wall Street, where hundreds of police were always around. And also to send a message not only about not arresting journalists, but not to engage in unlawful arrests at all. Now, I want to talk about going now to the election today. November 2008 was an historic moment, no question about it. I mean, in a land with a legacy of slavery, President Obama, the first African president, African-American president, is elected. That was historic, no matter what your political persuasion is. And I think the world heaved a sigh of relief on that night. You know, if people had felt for so long they'd hit their heads against a brick wall, the wall became a door, the door opened a crack. And the question is, would it be kicked open or slammed shut? But that's not up to the person in the White House. That's up to all of you in this hall and people like you all over this country. Because when the president is sitting in the Oval Office, yes, the most powerful person on earth, then those who are used to having his ear are whispering their demands into it. If he can't point out the window of the Oval Office and say, "If I do that, they will storm the Bastille," if no one's out there, he's in big trouble. And that's when he agrees with you. What about when you disagree with him? I mean, let's look at what's happened over these last 4 years. President Obama flew into Copenhagen and scuttled any kind of real, meaningful climate change agreement at the UN Climate Change Summit. He's presided over the longest war in U.S. history. He's presided over the deportations of more immigrants than any president in history. An interesting story: the first day of this Democratic convention, the UndocuBus pulled up that was filled with undocumented immigrants who had taken a bus from Phoenix to Charlotte to protest the Democrats. They'd given up on the Republicans, but the Democrats, though they hadn't done much for them, they felt maybe there was that crack, the door opened a crack. And it was an amazing thing to see. First day of the convention, the Democrats inside are gaveling the convention, and we get a text. A there's going to be some action. We go to a corner, and this bus pulls up, and Rosie Carrasco gets out first. She and her husband and her daughter were about to get arrested, among many other people who were gathered and walking fast, chanting, "No papers, no fear, no papers, no fear." And I'm interviewing Rosie Carrasco. We had had her on the show that morning, so it's important to watch Democracy Now! Or listen to Democracy Now! You often see people doing very interesting things. And at that point, when a well-known media personality came up to me, I'd been on some panels with him, and he said, "Hey, what's going on here? What are all these people doing?" And I was interviewing Rosie Carrasco. I said, "I think they're about to get arrested." He said, "No, but who are they? What do they want?" I said, "Well, they're undocumented immigrants." And he said, "But what do they want?" I said, "Well, why don't you ask one?" And, you know, he's racing off to go on television for the first day of the Democratic convention. It seems to me news is staring him in the face. And he said, "No, just, Amy, tell me quickly." And so I said, "Rosie, would you please tell this gentleman why it is that you're here?" And she said, "Because I want to know what kind of president, what kind of legacy President Obama wants to leave. I want to know if he wants to be remembered as the president who presided over more deportations of immigrants in history, or if he wants to be remembered as the president who sided with the immigrants." Pretty eloquent. And this media personality started taking notes. Why is it so hard for them to actually go to people who are targeted by policy and hear what it is they have to say? Martin Nzueta, Rosie's husband, he came out of the bus and said, "I've paid taxes in this country for 18 years, which is more than Citibank can say." And then they marched to the front of the convention, and the rain was pouring in, and so were the police. And these immigrants unfurled a banner with a big butterfly on it. I interviewed a woman who marched the whole way, a young woman with her arm wrapped around a much smaller woman. It was her mother. And she wouldn't let go of her. And, you know, President Obama responded to pressure this summer. I mean, you had the Dreamers, the young students who were undocumented, who risked so much when they sat in on his campaign offices and other congressmembers and senators' offices, because they don't risk just arrest. They risk deportation. But they did it, demanding passage of the DREAM Act. This was humiliating to President Obama. I mean, he was a community organizer. This is the modern-day civil rights movement. And so he did ultimately respond, passing a kind of executive order that said undocumented immigrants who meet a certain criteria, 30 years or under, can get a reprieve from deportation for something like 2 years and can work here legally and can go to school here. And these Dreamers were on the bus, too, because that wasn't enough for them. And so she had her arm wrapped around her mother. I said, "I bet you qualify, you know, for this kind of exemption." And she said, "I do, but my mother doesn't. And if she's deported, I might as well go with her." And then I asked another young woman who was on her knees on the banner about to be arrested, "Why the butterflies?" And she said, "Because butterflies know no borders. Butterflies are free." And with that, she was put in the police wagon. So what has President Obama presided over? The war, the gutting of climate change agreements, the deportations of immigrants. Under his administration, more whistleblowers have been charged with espionage than all presidents combined in history. So what do people do? Because the very movements that elected President Obama, I mean, you remember that first night, it was a tremendous victory. The anti-war movement. I mean, the reason President Obama, I believe, was the Democratic nominee is because Hillary Clinton supported the war in Iraq, and Barack Obama did not. She hung on to that position to the very end, to the very end. And when she saw she was going down, she finally said maybe she made a mistake. But Barack Obama was opposed to that war, not Afghanistan, but Iraq. So all these different movements, the environmental movement, the gay and lesbian movement, various civil rights, criminal justice movements, young people came out in unprecedented numbers. It was amazing. African Americans, people of color, higher percentages than any time in U.S. history. So what happens now? What happens when the commander-in-chief, rather the community organizer-in-chief, becomes the commander-in-chief? Who does the community organizing then? A few weeks after President Barack Obama was elected, before he was inaugurated, I was invited on CNN because the Obamas were going to the White House to be toured around by the Bushes, their new residence. And I was on with pundits from different studios, and I saw the video of them walking into the White House, and I said, we have to take pause. They were jabbering about something else. I said, Barack Hussein Obama, Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama, right? Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama is the descendant of slaves from the Carolinas. So their daughters, Malia and Sasha, are the descendants of slaves. And they're about all to live in the White House, the most famous house on earth, which was built by slaves. We must take pause. And I thought about a house down the road, which I've talked about here before, but I had given this vicinity and Taos and other properties owned, I thought I would raise it again. A house down the road, about an hour and a half from the White House, which, it's where this area was where Frederick Douglass was born, the great abolitionist, right? He was enslaved as a youth and a teenager, and it might not surprise you to know he was a troublesome slave, so he was handed over to Ed Covey, a man called the Slave Breaker, and he beat him on his property. He tortured him, but Frederick Douglass escaped, headed north, and changed the world. That property, Ed Covey's property, was called Mount Misery. And Mount Misery was then bought in 2003 by Donald Rumsfeld. He lived next to his, down the road from his good friend, Vice President Dick Cheney. And when I read this, I was pretty amazed because, you know, Mount Misery is Donald Rumsfeld's vacation home. So I, you know, and especially for young people who are watching and listening to this, the internet is essential and we must protect it, but it can also be a global rumor mill and you have to check your sources. You know, it is very important. And so Dennis and I headed down to St. Michael's, Maryland to see if this was true. Now, I go to this coffee house in New York in an old brick building. There's a plaque on the outside that says Frederick Douglass took refuge here in the building of the printing press of David Ruggles, born a free black man in Connecticut. And this is a really profound point. Frederick Douglass started the North Star newspaper. And Frederick Douglass had this, and David Ruggles had this printing press. These men saw the media as their form of liberation, of emancipation, because information is power. So Dennis and I headed down to St. Michael's, and I realized I had no idea where Donald Rumsfeld lived, and I had about an hour to figure this out because we had to speak in Washington. And I saw this independent coffee shop right ahead of us. I said, oh, they'll tell the truth. So we went inside, and they said, what do you want? And I said, I want to know where Donald Rumsfeld lives. And they said, oh, just go out back, go down the road. You'll hit Mount Pleasant Road. Don't go down that road. You make a right and another right, and you'll hit Mount Misery Road. Go down the road, and that's where he lives. So we figure we're on to something. We go down the road, and we don't go down Mount Pleasant. We take a right and another right. It seemed we couldn't go right enough until we hit the black tinted windows of the Secret Service SUV and we knew we'd arrived. So I'm get out my video camera. I'm zooming in as they're zooming out. And I'm thinking, does Secretary Rumsfeld know the significance of this property that he owns? But sure enough, I see a stake in the ground next to the driveway that says Mount Misery. So we head off to an ancient black church down the road. It's Sunday morning, and I speak to an older woman who is the descendant of slaves, and I said to her, what do you make of all this? This historic place, Frederick Douglass is born here. He's enslaved here. He's tortured at Mount Misery. It's now owned by Donald Rumsfeld, who's known for torture. What do you make of this? And she said, I can't comment right now. We're in church. So from Mount Misery to Mount Hope, in Rochester, New York, I was speaking there a few years ago, and a young woman came up to me at the end of the talk and said, could I take you to Mount Hope Cemetery? I said, I'm leaving for Denver at 6 a.m. I cannot miss my plane. She said, okay, so let's meet at 4. Well, with that kind of determination, I met her at 4, middle of a snowstorm. She takes me to Frederick Douglass's tombstone, and we brush off the snowflakes. And she says, could I take you across the cemetery? It's a big cemetery. I want to show you another tombstone. I said, oh, my God, please. Okay. So we go across the cemetery, and there is the tombstone of Susan B. Anthony, who's buried next to her sister. Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass were not just friends. They were allies. There's a statue of them near Susan B. Anthony's house, not of a general, but of Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony having tea together. You know, Susan B. Anthony, not just the great suffragist and feminist, she supported abolition. And Frederick Douglass was a great feminist as well. He seconded the resolution presented at the 1848 Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention for women to have the right to vote. The women's rights movement, the abolition movement, these are the movements that have made this country great. So I raced off to the airport and missed my plane. And I call up Dennis, and I said, Dennis, quick, you've got to get me on the next plane. And he brings up the blueprints of the airport. He is an incredible researcher, except that I just wanted a ticket. And so anyway, he says, are you in the Susan B. Anthony wing or the Frederick Douglass wing? I said, oh, come on, don't joke around. He said, I'm not joking. And I look, Susan B. Anthony, Frederick Douglass. Every once in a while, you just have to stop and smell the coffee. So I am repeating some stories, especially because I know that young people are here, high school students and college students, and the issue of movements is so important. And so very quickly, and I've already hit zero on my time, but I'm just going to take 5 more minutes. And then afterwards, I would love to sign books. You don't have to get books, but if you want to come back and just say hi, it's also the way we learn about so many stories. And if you get 2 books, it's wonderful to work with Collected Works, because independent bookstores are, I won't say becoming an endangered species, but thousands of them are being shuttered, and we must maintain these wonderful oases of dissent. And so we have this wonderful DVD. I spent the hour with Michael Moore on Democracy Now! Talking about his life. And if you would like to get that, that comes free with some books. And think about holiday and graduation, shopping and birthdays. And, you know, I don't know if Dennis told the story, but did he tell the story of Juan? He took Juan Gonzalez around read Juan's books. News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race in the American Media has just come out. It's fantastic. And the book before that, Harvest of Empire, the epic, the untold story of Latinos in America, the movie has just been made based on his groundbreaking book. Both are fantastic. And Dennis toured Juan around for a couple of days with Joe Torres, his co-author. And the book got on the New York Times bestseller list, which is so important for so many reasons. It sends a message to publishers that these kinds of voices have an audience. We call them, a citizenry, the population of this country. And so many bookstores, certainly not Collected Works, but only stock the first top 10 or the top 20. People go into these bookstores hungry for something, and to be able to find a roadmap or ideas that point you in another direction is so important. So Juan's book gets on the New York Times bestseller list. It comes in right under Harry Belafonte, and it knocks Dick Cheney down a notch. So Rosa Parks, in 2 minutes, we all know the story. Rosa Parks sits down on the bus December 1st, 1955, refuses to get up for a white passenger, and in so doing, she launches the modern-day civil rights movement. This was in Montgomery, Alabama, and a few days later, when she goes to court, the Montgomery Improvement Association has its meeting to elect a spokesperson to lead the bus boycott that will lead to the desegregation of the transportation system. And they choose a young minister who just come into town. His name was Dr. Martin Luther King. Rosa Parks helped to launch Dr. King. Now, when she died, we raced to Washington because she was the first African-American woman to lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda. Her body was then brought to a Washington church. Thousands came out. Oprah was there. Cicely Tyson was there. Loudspeakers were set up for all the people outside. We were outside where it's often more interesting to be. And I interviewed a young student and I said, what are you doing here? And she said, oh, I emailed my professors and I said, I won't be in class today. I'm going to get an education. Don't quote me on that. Okay. So, how did the media get this story wrong? We all agree on the facts. Well, they said that Rosa Parks was a tired seamstress. She was no troublemaker. Rosa Parks was a first-class troublemaker. She knew exactly what she was doing. She was the secretary of the local NAACP. She worked with E.D. Nixon. He was the local president of the NAACP. He had worked with A. Philip Randolph, the greatest organizer of the 20th century, who organized the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the Black porters on the Pullman trains They were slaves. They had been, or their fathers were, or their mothers were. And they were all called George for the owner of the train, George Pullman. Of course, their mothers hadn't named them George, which indicates a little why they needed to be organized. A. Philip Randolph goes on to organize the 1963 March on Washington. E.D. Nixon worked with him, worked with Rosa Parks. They had been working for years to challenge the racist laws. She had trained at the Highlander Center. So had Martin Luther King. You know, where black and white together had worked to most effectively strategize to change the laws of this country. She knew exactly what she was doing. She sat down on the bus before, refusing to get up as other young women had. But this was the magic moment. And you never know when that magic moment will come. But if you are involved with social change, you help to build a foundation that will determine history, that will determine the future. The media denigrates activists, but what can be more noble than dedicating your life to making the world a better place? And to show how brave Rosa Parks was, she was deeply affected by what happened a few months before, the summer of Emmett Till. The 14-year-old African-American boy in Chicago, his mother, Mamie, wanted him out of the city for the summer, so she sends him to be with aunt and uncle and cousins in Money, Mississippi. And he was sleeping one night in their house when a white mob came and pulled him out of bed, and they beat him. They said he wolf-whistled at a white woman. His mother, Mamie, had taught him. He was a stutterer. And she taught Emmett that when you stutter, you should whistle. He ended up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. When his body was dredged up and sent back to Chicago, his mother, Mamie Till, did something very courageous. She said she wanted his casket open for the wake and the funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry. Thousands passed by his casket and saw. Then Jet Magazine and other black publications took photographs of his distended, mutilated head, and they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till did something very important. She had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures. Show the images. Could you imagine if for just one week, on this 11th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, the longest war in U.S. history, for just one week, we saw the images of war. Every day, above the fold of every surviving newspaper, a photograph, a story about a baby dead on the ground, perhaps from a drone attack in Pakistan or Yemen. And I hope everyone reads the report from Stanford Law School and NYU Law School that just came out called Living Under Drones, that documents 2% of the people killed, the thousands, have been so-called high-level targets. So what about the other 98%? Just read that report. But if for the next week we saw a story about a baby killed in a drone attack, or the top of every TV and radio newscast, the top story about a soldier dead or dying, or on everyone's Facebook wall, every tweet, every email was a message about war, referred to a woman with her legs blown off by cluster bombs. For just one week, Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. And I want to end with this. The last days of the Egyptian revolution before Mubarak fell, there was this young blogger named Karim Amer. He had been imprisoned for 4 years by Mubarak for blogging against the state. But he was out in Tahrir, and then he disappeared. No one knew where he went. And Dennis and I were writing the column that week, and I was tweeting Sharif, I was texting Sharif, you know, what happened to Karim? And no one knew. They saw him walking away from Tahrir and he disappeared. And then Dennis went to his blog. And on top of the blog, it said, this blog is dedicated to Hans and Sophie Scholl. Hans and Sophie were a brother and sister in Nazi Germany. They weren't Jewish, but they were German Christians. And they thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? And together with their professor and other students and workers, they formed the White Rose Collective. And they published 6 pamphlets. On the 4th was written the words, "We will not be silent." They got these pamphlets out everywhere. They'd have them dropped in the middle of the night in a courtyard or in a marketplace in an alleyway. And then they were captured. They were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded by the Nazis. But that motto, that slogan on the 4th pamphlet, the words, "We will not be silent," those words should be the Hippocratic oath of the media today, should be the Hippocratic oath of us all today. We will not be silent. Democracy Now!
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.